These are two short poems written in Alarin El Grande, which is a town in Andalusia, Spain. Alarin El Grande means garden of Allah, and they were both written on the campo, which is the countryside for which the town was named. First one's called Sunset Photograph. Watching with friends, wine flows, coffee becomes cool, thereby faulty. Scents of citrus and aromatic herbs. The clouds fanfare autumnal colours of sunset, diffractions of red and orange enlarged on jet trails of natural origin. Sudden as focus shifting, colour slips to grey echoes of night as deep violets tinged with burnt yellow welcome the setting sun behind the mountains. And the second poem is about fireworks. It was the finale of the festival in Alarin El Grande. The dogs begin to bark. Tracer trails of gold sparks, myriad warp speed points blooming before the boom, echoing from the hills. Myriad fountains of coloured lights, metallic floral hues on gold and silver filament, starburst flash and flicker, seeding the sky. Passion flower portals, a serrated palm flutters, far-flung flame. Smoke, mini mushroom clouds fade to blow with breezes round horseshoe hills from the sea. On the campo, as the reverberating ripples recede, Alarin settles to twinkle familiar. The red-lit mast's preeminence returns after temporary abatement. Smoke slips to amorphous cloud. The dogs, again, are quiet. Thank you.
Thanks, Simon. Next is Jason Ashford.
Hello, my name is Jason. I come from Northern Ireland, so I hope you can understand my accent. If you can't, you can make up your own words. It might be better in this one. I do run an open mic night up in Belfast, so if anybody wants to come out to Belfast, we run it every month. It's called Red Pill, and I run Facebook and Twitter and stuff. Check us out. We'd love to have everybody. Northern Ireland is the last place on the island of Ireland, or the island of Britain, where marriage equality doesn't exist. After your referendum last year. So I wrote this. It's called An Open Letter to Northern Irish Church Leaders Regarding Marriage Equality. My brothers and sisters of the church, from the bottom of my humble heart, salutations. I wish I wrote to you in happier times. Instead, I write as the Catholic Church faces its greatest threat in over a century. What I talk about is a threat to Christian decency, an offence to religious liberty. I am, of course, talking about werewolves. See, while you guys were acting the dick, getting yourselves on the wrong side of history by opposing marriage equality, you forgot all about werewolves. Somehow, the thought of two consenting adults very much in love spending the rest of their lives together with the same rights as their straight peers is scarier to you than werewolves. So let me remind you of the difference between the lycan community and the LGBT community. Werewolves are 9 foot tall, half man, half wolf, demons that feast on human flesh. A gay person is a person just like you, only, generally speaking, better dressed. Werewolves are not real. Gay people are. Despite this, werewolves are still 100% more of a threat to your church and your laws. Full disclosure. I'm not a huge fan of your church or your laws. I lost God. Shed him like an old skin at the age of 17. Find him again in St. Peter's Basilica, my provincial jaw ripped open by the beauty I saw around me. I asked the priest, how do I find my way back to my church oh my God, to the feeling when I felt like the all-knowing father held me against his chest, the first thing he asked me was whether or not I was having premarital sex. You guys are more obsessed with dicks than any gay guy I've ever met. And full disclosure, I'm not a huge fan of your church or your laws, but I'm a huge fan of your man, Jesus. Love that he never had time for the priest up in the temple, but never missed an opportunity to have a drink with a prostitute or a leper. I reckon if Christ was alive in 21st century Belfast, he'd spend every Saturday night in our gay clubs turning water into shots and screaming, love is love is love, and above all else, God is love. You guys have the opportunity to stand with the oppressed against their oppressors. You get it wrong, and I don't think Christ will be too impressed. And on the last day, he might meet you at the pearly gates with some knuckle dusters and some of his gay mates. You guys need to recalibrate what you care about, and I know it's hard. I know it's hard to break a lifetime's habit, but if you really must stand up and spit hate from your pulpit, then at least do something useful and hand out silver bullets. Thanks.
Thank you, Jason. Next is Amy McAllister.
Hi. I'm gonna do something stupid there, even though that was really like important and stuff. I didn't know that there was a TV show called Modern Family. Maybe some of you don't know either, but there is. So this is called that, but it's nothing to do with Modern Family. Okay. If, when I turn 37, many years from now, I find myself immersed in solitude, shriveling, and nowhere near a baby, I won't be seen in New Look's Younger Generation section, squeezing into animal print skinnies with a modern purple twist, then showing off to random city workers in a Shoreditch nightclub by cramming my entire fist into my mouth. Nor will you find me working my way through my list of exes who might not be quite such cheese dicks after all, in hope of finding one still single who's willing to enlist and knock me up. I won't be joining Match or Guardian Soulmates, swapping lies and photographs with rapey strangers. No, you won't catch me on singleswithfoodallergies.com. Nor will I work away my Sunday evening watching Hollywood plump size one leading ladies weep away their Sunday evening in this weekend's Freeview rom-com bomb before another fearful late night Google of the nearest sperm donation center to my house, trawling through donors' profiles and avoiding those who haven't written in the box reserved for private island owners, as well as any man whose hair looks like a giant bleaching mouse. I won't ask all my married friends to set me up with their most eligible social runs, because let's face it, if they've never shared a razor with a woman, they are likely to be total cunts, or at the very least in love with corpses, or their mother, or the corpse of their dead mother. I have a much less messy plan of action up my sleeve, a sleeker pathway to relieving pangs of longing for a spot of love and parenthood. I'm going to build a robot husband, and a little robot baby too. The baby robot will be awesome mainly because it won't have orifices that enable it to cry or poo. The husband robot will be patient and be extra good at doing DIY because its wrists will come with power tool attachments, and its face will be a curving screen displaying any guy I'm fancying from off the telly. And its robot pits will be incapable of getting smelly, but they'll still be hairy because I like a bit rough. And he'll be tough enough to make me feel unthreatened if some teenagers start throwing chicken nuggets at my head when on the bus. He'll face them out and make a fuss, but manage not to end up dead. And he'll be oh so wonderful in bed, equipped with tiny heat pads at his fingertips and front suspension in his hips, his lips a GPS device, the destination set to clit. Sorry. And when I'm in the mood for comfort, he'll be courteous and nice and give me lots of lovely hugs. But when I tire of that, there'll be a special button that I flick which turns my robot prince into a prick who's high on drugs, but in a dangerously sexy kind of way. He'll love to swim and hike, but not get judgy if I fancy Krispy Kremes for dinner. In fact, he'll worry if he thinks I'm getting thinner and encourage me to buy a brick of cheese and lose control, insisting that I grow another stomach roll. He'll know about good barbecuing practice and the traffic and the weather. And my robot husband, unlike you, we'll never realize he's gay 6 weeks after we bought a flat together.
Thank you. Sue Cosgrave next.
Hi everyone, I've just got two pages of prose, if that's okay. It's from a short story I've been reading for a few weeks now. It's set in Soviet Russia in the 70s, and it's about a young couple living in a tenement on the top floor of a tenement, and there's thoughts in the attic. The story is called In the Attic. So I'll start from where I left last time. By the time Anyushka managed to leave, and she left the flat of the caretaker, she had a thumping headache. On her way up the stairs, she met the tenant from number 4, who stepped aside politely, smiled and mumbled a greeting before continuing on his way. Such a shy man, his eyes so kind and gentle. She knew very little about him. Some said he was a scientist, others that he was a teacher. Perhaps he was both. Anyushka wondered at Tatiana Fyodorovna's interest in him. It left her feeling uneasy and a little bit guilty, for it was she who had let slip about the gatherings in his room. Men and women of all ages, but mostly older, who came and went at odd hours of the night, always so quiet, faces averted as they passed her on the stairs. And so it was that as she waited for Kolya's return home, she paced nervously about the room. The next few days were all bustle and excitement, and usually prepared her class for that year's May Day parade. When the important day finally dawned, it was bright, but dark clouds would threaten the rain. In the end, only drizzled, a slow, cold soaking that diffused the gray light, rendering the gathering crowds in sepia like an image from an old photograph. The children were the only ones unbothered by the weather. The girls twirled their pleated blue skirts, stiff white chiffon ribbons giving them the look of top-heavy dolls. The boys had to be restrained from throwing their red wedge hats at each other as they played chase around the hall. When they were finally given permission to march, Anyushka's heart hammered in her chest for fear that something would go wrong. But the children behaved impeccably. They all turned their faces in unison as they marched past Lenin's mausoleum, and there was Comrade Brezhnev in the flesh. Anyushka was surprised how old he looked and how tired. His stiff arm raised in salute looked like something attached to his greatcoat, almost like a theatrical prop. And as it went past, for no reason at all, she felt pity flood her heart, not only for poor Comrade Brezhnev, but for all those around her, for the cheering crowds, for Kolya waving a flag somewhere beyond the barricade, for the young soldiers marching stiffly ahead, for poor Stepan Andreevich, and for the sad-eyed tenant in number 4. She even felt pity for a troop of little children, carefree and happy though they were. Even the bleak, overcast sky seemed to beg for her compassion. She lay awake all that night, listening to the thuds moving about the ceiling like a drunken mazurka. Whenever she shut her eyes, she could almost hear the old-fashioned music somewhere far away, like something remembered rather than heard, but not any less real for that. The following evening, the handyman Matvey finally showed up. "So, I hear you have a problem," he bellowed in a voice that dripped accusation the way only handyman can convey. "It's the attic," she stammered. "There's something up there, moving about." Matvey lifted a face, hewn not so much from stone as from cheese, pitted and nibbled, its yellow hue a testament to a jaundiced life. He pointed his warty nose at the ceiling so he could smell whatever was hidden there. "Mice," he barked at last and turned as if to go. "Wait," cried Anyushka, "aren't you going to do something about it?" "What's the point? They'll keep coming back." "It can't be mice. They make such a racket. Like they're big, really big." "Ah, big, eh? Like rats?" "No, much bigger." Matvey craned his neck and stared at the trapdoor. It wasn't so much a trapdoor as planks nailed together to form a square about a meter across had to be pushed aside to gain entry. Thick layer of paint had covered the cracks around the trapdoor was a testament that not even a spider could have gained entry to the space beyond. After a few moments, Matvey lowered his gaze and gave Anyushka a sour look. "There's nothing there for the rats, not a morsel. Used to be piled high with old rubbish, leftovers from when this was a family home back in Tsarist times. All gone now, burned for firewood during the war. Ah, Stepan Andreevich, if you don't believe me, his family owned this place. Maybe he knows something about it, eh? Maybe when you're not looking, his legs up and prances about his bread, his bow down. Speaking of which, and here he lowered his voice and moved a step closer, I've got jeans straight from America, genuine Levi's. Just what a carefree young one like you needs to get the heads turning again. What about it, eh? Good price, especially for you. Anyushka flushed. She shook her head and did her best to avoid my face, roomy eye. Is this trapdoor the only access? She finally mustered the courage to ask. My face sniffed in disgust and turned to go. No other way to get to the attic except through the trapdoor there. I should know. Saying which, he fell down the stairs, leaving a defeated Anyushka staring at her feet. Young and carefree, had called her, but she felt old, immeasurably old. Seemed the building's history, its past, and even its future had seeped into her marrow, leaching the flesh of her bones. The sight of her feet encased in cradle slippers depressed her even further. For just so she did remember her mother from the knees down, worn slippers and feet splayed wide from too much standing. The memory brought a cold shiver to the base of her neck, a familiar tingling that recalled the fairy tales her mother used to tell, stories that were meant to keep her daughter from straying far into the woods as they gathered mushrooms in the fall. In these stories, little girls invariably came to a sticky end. There was one about the skeletal people wandering in the countryside scouring for flesh, a few other stories told of naughty children snatched and eaten. Then there was the one that frightened Anyushka the most, about hands that sprouted in the forest glades to grasp the unwary ankles of passers-by. Young girls, of course, who ignored the advice of their mothers. For the first time, she wondered if these horrors were lifted wholesale from mother's real experience of life, or if perhaps they were things she had witnessed. In a vague sort of way, Anyushka knew that her generation's comforts had come at a price. But surely, the old and corrupt had to be swept away to make space for the new and pure. It must be so. After all, it says so in all her history books. She was so absorbed in her thoughts that the sound of her name whispered at close quarters made her jump out of her skin. Psst! Anna Gavrilova! And there was Stepan Andreevich, peering at her from behind his partially open door. All she could see of him was one red-rimmed eye, a corner of his shaggy beard, and a shiny with dirt dressing gown. She started scurrying towards her own door, but his next words stopped her in her tracks. Anna Gavrilovna, they have spoken to you. Yes? She turned around. They? Who do you mean, Stepan Andreevich? But Stepan Andreevich's eye had already shifted his fingers, which wriggled her through the gap. Fountain pens, he whispered to himself. You can't get fountain pens these days. You write and you write, but the page stays blank. All you get for your troubles are ink blots in your fingers. Anyushka's gaze strayed to the narrowed fingers that now clutched the edge of the door. For the first time, she noticed how stained they were, the nails black with grime like a bird's talons. You have heard them, haven't you? He asked again louder this time. It won't be long now, just you wait. They take everything from you, your soul, the sweat of your brow. They leave their voices behind, though, mocking you day and night. Stepan Andreevich closed his eyes and let his forehead rest against the door. Anyushka moved a step closer. How strange that she had never noticed how fine his face looked in profile. Just so were heroes of the revolution depicted in murals. Straight noses, firm lips, well-defined jaws. But just as suddenly his lids snapped open to reveal watery eyes swimming in pools of burst veins. And he started to cry, like a child, unselfconsciously and without inhibition, drooling and sniffling into sleep. Stepan Andreevich, please, she started to say, but the old man closed his door in her face, leaving her feeling lost and totally bereft. Thank you.
Mary O'Connell is next.
Thanks, Ben. This is actually drawn from life, shall we say. I had a sign on my gate and it was getting very dilapidated, so I thought I'd wander down to Hickey's and see if they could mend it or maybe replace it. And out of that came this poem. It's called Not a Sign. Saturday morning in Hickey's. I tried to explain to the lad at the till when a figure in white appears at my side. I think I could help you with that. Is the sign on your gate metal or wood? The lettering embossed or engraved? I turn and I trust. Set out what I need. The angel in overalls asks where I live. I give him my number as well. Thoughts of axe murderers flit through my head, fade in the light of his smile. He says he is called Charlie Green. He'll ring as soon as he's free. At the end of 9 days, not a word. Back in the store, they reveal the painter is not on their staff. I shrug. Nothing gained, nothing lost. Then he rings. I hear his concern. The work in Cape Clear took an age. The following day, he takes down the sign. He has plenty of varnish at home. It should help to keep down the cost. Overjoyed, I show him a list of odd jobs put off for too long. He will tackle them all in due course. Won't send me the bill till the end. There and then, he starts trimming the hedge, pulls up a few weeds by the step. I call him my medieval knight. He laughs. I'm a Virgo. That's why I thrive on hard work. I reply, and you know about star signs as well. He'll come back in a fortnight, he says. I never see him again.
Charles Clark, next.
This is not what you might think. It is very brief, but it is not a kind of a piece of flash fiction. It is intended, in fact, to be a small part of a very long work. It is about my starts, at least, my uncle, about whom everybody agreed. He certainly had a book in him. There's a book definitely there. Somebody who had, in his early days, left Clongowes, having burst an eardrum, and who had contemplated going to Spain in the mid-30s, but not on holiday, do you understand? And subsequently a lot more. Married the girl from second next door. Anyways, this is comes from a slightly later phase. Billy had retired early in his mid-50s. An opportunity had presented itself and he went. In Ireland of the older times, nobody ever retired. His father went into his office in his mid-80s, greeting customers, taking stamps off envelopes. Now he had time on his hands. A new government had been elected. Billy was profoundly shocked when one of its first actions was to pay Dáil deputies more. He wrote a letter to the Taoiseach in which he said that he always thought that Fine Gael was the only honest party. A leading historian asked me, did he get an answer? I had asked the same question, so I knew that the reply was yes. That particular government had a lot on its hands. The oil crisis, the violence in the north, the public finances. Yet Mr. Cosgrave, who's still alive by the way, found that I had time to write a letter to an obscure supporter in West Cork. It tells you a lot, quite a lot, about Irish politics. Not that Billy did not consider his own life in more personal terms, telling everybody that he was going to spend 3 months in Australia. The whole town knew about it, but his wife thought otherwise and found a way out. He did not go.
Thank you, Charles. Patricia Walsh is next.
Thank you, Ben. It's called a twisted robot. A disembodied ringtone grows unchecked. A war within wars, countrymen askew. People of steel stand in unison, finally happy. War by recount, thin paper victorious. Stars of war are taking the spoils home. Laying siege to personal cliche, avoiding repetition where not intended. Mistaken for style of redundant phrases, dogma by very life, avoidance permitted. A life without secrets, known out loud, ridiculed in a public room at home. My life is interesting, how I don't know, being hit continually by only reverent. Alas, I am still divided by gunshot. Till the end of the world, I sing my praises. Face if dies, not last in the distance. A new life lasting the frying alarm. Head count not coming quick enough. There's not for that. We the people demand pizza and Netflix and now. Who God made bad, still beyond reproach. Coming for entertainment on doorsteps. Ahead of the window, winos shutting home. Maddening hatters at war by themselves, now realizing revelation time unseen. Still slouched revolution on others' terms, eating nothing but the rich, God willing. Hearing to hell, I find a solution of sorts, getting rid of reluctances, so a permanent job. Dark times, decent people, was for this, that we break elusive bonds, soothing out the air, to estate idiots in the course of their actions. Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia. Next is Alexis Campbell-Bannerman.
Thank you, Ben, for letting me read the following poem. It is a truth universally acknowledged that once in your life you should read a disgusting poem about a goat. Okay, this one is based on the 5-foot challenge. It's called Loosened Goat. I woke from the most powerful dream. I was scared that it would rain, like the air from tired whipped cream. But this was a powerful dream. It was a pastiche of colours of light. I looked closer and it was right, right close to my skin. It felt like sin. Before I saw it was a goat, a lucid, seducent goat, and that I had become aroused gave me, on waking, the dry throat.
Thank you. The erotic goat poem. Michelle Delia next.
So I've been a little bit playful, I've been a bit curious about what happens when you weave two poems together and they make kind of a weird dialogue with each other, like something new, and then you read it back like it's not yours, and I don't know. So I tried that a bit. One's kind of about words and one's about the apocalypse, so here's what happens when they break bread.
poetry. Easier said than done. Easier done than spoken. Easier spoken than provoking something. Easier written than vessel from whichever upper limb is friends most. With your messy penthouse, clean it up, write it out. What are your plans for the coming dawn? What are your plans for the dusk of the apocalypse? Do you want to find some swings and swing on them with me? Or sing something between a noise and a scream, somewhere between the lights on the street? Do you think as we swing and scream we could simultaneously read poetry? And the words with which up you grew are cast ball now to choreograph the paragraph you use to investigate how best to translate yourself. Explore the imploring of them, promote them and give them a pension, or spit them into your own reflection, rippling eye contact with yourself. You'd always felt you'd enter death staring at your love lastly, but did you think the feeling would be mutual with every other ancient soul, each one creeping into memories of their ancestors' lives, a shared mind finally seeing the arc of the earth, the beauty, the bloodshed of each and every death you've lived through, each and every death you did not. It is your final time to die, my sibling, and you welcome it like an old friend that will not leave this time or ever again. And how you've taffy pulled your language, all for when you'd meet it on the way down from small talk or the way up from depression, when you're stuck but equipped, expressing to someone else caught up in the sludge of themselves. Your words will be easier said than done when you fed them all along to the birth of a new star, to its embarkment on this great arc, to the beauty and the bloodshed to come, to the balance, to the balance. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. Next is Kieran McCartan.
The wire is caught in the building.
The road. Head full of big town politics and I steady strode, trying to make sense of all of it. I lighten my load at just the thought of it, and I know the code, though I need never talk of it. As above, so below, I digest without swallowing. The markings pass me slow, head walks and feet are following. The new stem and grow, old thoughts take breath from wallowing. What did I ever know of the pictures I've been coloring? The ways in which I'm set cast rays across my retina. The image they project will blind if I keep letting it fill me with regret, as though I had affected it, as though I could expect someone to have protected it. Those of whom I ask too much, I see on the road before me, that outline in the clouds, reflect in the water's glory. They tell me not to fear, that they will always adore me, tell me not to turn my back, that they want me in their story. The faces that I see, those that my spirit has chosen, will always be with me, land, sky, river, and ocean. In my mind they roam free, for our paths have been woven. From where the dawn burns and breaks, to where the evening sky is golden, I must strive for an awareness of my own frail psychology, so that I might act out of fairness, and need issue no apology to he who knew best, who fell victim to chronology. What would my future self have said, if I could hear him call to me? take responsibility for every possibility of fate that I will live to see my happiness come back to me out on the road, firmly step to let the mind expel regret of new perspectives to correct and fresh loves to protect, gently learn and to home happily return.
Right, that's the end of the night. Give yourself a huge round of applause. And another round of applause, please, for our guest poet, Christine Bro. I think we'll be going to Maine's, the wine bar around the corner. I might end with a poem by a friend of mine called Renaud Contini. I hadn't read his poetry in a few years, and I went on this blog and I saw this one. It's called Exit. Children and adults are equally fond of wondering what their favorite words are. Did you notice too? It never gets old. When you listen attentively, you see patterns shaping up and looking less than real. There are the big words, the small words, the unusual words, the curses, the love words. All in all, it's a pretty surreal affair. But in the midst of this mess, it's occurred to me that people love this game because it's about them. Picking their favorite word, speaking it to the world, is like saying, this represents, in a word, what I am. So you hear things like kindness, joy, platypus, anything to seem kind, joyous, original. People never pick words like grime, dirty, evil, because they signify something behind their sound, and that something is, I guess, abhorrent. Now, I don't really like any of these words either, but there is one underrated word I love. It's the word exit. In my eyes, that word is a whole world. First of all, it's easy to say. A democratic word, often used in everyday life, but not only. Even when we're not speaking, we say the word exit. Even when we're not thinking, we say the word exit. And that's because we are always, in some way, creating new exits for ourselves, in dreaming, but also in the full swing of waking life. Every decision, every act, every form of choice is a leap into life's next event, an exit towards the next state of affairs, with new rules of the game, new chances, and a lot of fun to be had, for sure.